I'm Steve Clark. I'm the convener of the seminars. If you haven't been here for a while, you, Julian Savulescu, was the previous convener and still is the director of the Euhero Centre. Now, we're very pleased for our very first talk of the year to be able to hear from Dr. Francesca Minerva, who is going to give us a talk on something to do with conscientious objection. It is in fact called conscientious objection in medicine, what is wrong with a moderate approach. The format is the following. We have an hour and a half in which we're going to do three things. We'll listen to Francesca's talk, we'll have a informal discussion, and then we have some wine to drink. So we're somewhat variable about how that goes, but let's just see how it goes. You're all being recorded, so if you have an objection to being recorded, if you feel the urge to ask a question, there are two things you can do. One is not ask a question. The other is come and see me afterwards and say, please delete my question from the recording. But otherwise, the recording will go on our website and we podcast for all to hear. Okay, so without further ado, take it away, Francesca.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm sorry, I cannot stay here because I'm too small. I would be here and we pretend that I'm there. If I could go back in time and choose a different topic for my PhD dissertation, I would choose a different subject because I cannot pronounce conscientious objection in English. Now I can say very well in Italian, obiezione di coscienza, but if I say that, you won't understand me. So I decided I would try to repeat so many times conscientious objection the wrong way that when you go into this room, you would think that the right way to pronounce it is my way. So let's try that. So I'm sure that many of you heard the expression conscientious objection refer to the military service. So to people who refuse to be enrolled in the military service because they don't want to use weapons or to be involved in wars. Well, conscientious objection in medicine has very little to do with this kind of conscientious objection to the military service, at least in my understanding. For many reasons, but mainly for three reasons that I'm going to explain you. First of all, doctors who object to perform an abortion or any other activity they think might conflict with their conscience don't pay any price for their disobedience to the law. Instead, if one wants to refuse to be enrolled in the military service, he usually has to compensate and to be enrolled in a community service or to make up in any other way to this refusal. Secondly, the consequences of the refusal don't fall on the shoulders of the person who objects, in this case the doctor, but on the patient. So if the doctor refuses to perform an abortion, then the burden is on the patient because she has to go and find another doctor who will perform the intervention she requires. Instead, in the case of conscientious objection to the military service, it's the objector himself who has to compensate. And third, the refusal to be involved to the compulsory military service is a refusal to be involved at all with an activity that one believes to be moral, the use of weapons or worse. Instead, in the case of conscientious objection in medicine, the doctor freely decides to become a doctor, and then he says something like, okay, I want to be a doctor, but I don't want to do this or that activity that I'm supposed to do. So it's like someone who decides to be a soldier and to be in the military service, but then says, well, I don't want to fight that war. I don't want to use guns. I just want to use bombs. So it's strange. It's different. Anyway, I think that conscientious objection in medicine can be defined as the refusal to obey a law that imposes a duty to perform activities which are considered immoral or unfair by the objector. Conscientious objection, therefore, expresses a conflict between a legal and a moral imperative. In the medical context, we talk about conscientious objection when a healthcare practitioner refuses to perform a safe, legal, and beneficial procedure he would be otherwise expected to perform, because his own concerns about the morality of this activity. In order to understand better the meaning of the expression conscientious objection, I think we need to clarify two other words. One is conscience, and the other one is moral integrity. Conscience, for obvious reasons, and the moral integrity, because the safeguard of the doctor's moral integrity is the reason why we take into consideration conscientious objection. So it's the reason behind. I don't think it's the duty of the analytical philosopher to try to define words as conscience, God, soul, angel, this kind of foggy and confusing words. But I will try to. No, I will try, actually. I will use the definition of Denbrock. Who says that I shall understand by conscience an individual's faculty for making moral judgments together with a commitment to acting on them. For many persons, their consciences are deeply informed by their religious beliefs and commitments, but there is no necessary connection between conscience and religion, since many non-religious persons are equally possessed of moral commitments and conscience. So the good news is that you're entitled to have a conscience, even if you're not religious. That's good. It follows, and I use the Denbrock definition again, that deeply held and important moral judgments on conscience constitute the central basis of individual moral integrity. They define who, at least morally speaking, the individual is, what she stands for, what is the central moral code of her character. Maintaining her moral integrity then requires that she not violates her moral commitments and gives others reason to respect her doing so, not because those commitments must be true or justified, but because the maintenance of moral integrity is an important value central to one's status as a moral person. I don't agree with the second part of the definition. I think that people should provide rational justification in order to have a right to a conscience to be protected. But this is broad definition, and seems this understanding of moral integrity is kind of widespread, because in all the countries where abortion is legal, there are conscience clauses that allow doctors to refuse to perform activities related to the abortion. I think the reason why conscience clauses are so widespread, as far as I know, the only country in Europe where conscience clauses are not provided is Sweden, and in the United States, Oregon, and everywhere else, abortion is legal, there is a conscience clause. Has to do with the intrinsic nature of practice as abortion that becomes kind of the representation of the moral horizon of the person. So it's easy to understand why the legislators who are trying to legalize abortion try to find a balance between people who didn't want abortion to become legal and people who want abortion to become legal, and introduce these conscience clauses. But I wonder if the fact that conscientious objection is legal implies that conscientious objection is also moral. I think we need to ask ourselves, is it conscientious objection in medicine morally justifiable? Well, the literature provided three different answers to this question. That can be divided into three groups. Some ethicists believe that doctors should have an absolute right to object. Other ethicists argue that doctors should have a moderate right to object. And other ones believe that doctors should have no right to object. we have to keep in mind that the right to object can be expressed referring to three different activities, basically. The objection to inform a patient about the availability of a particular treatment, like abortion or the use of the morning after pill or some treatments for a disease like Alzheimer's that have been developed using stem cells from human embryos that arise some moral problems. And then there is the objection to refer a patient to a willing doctor that will practice the intervention or the treatment that the first doctor doesn't want to provide. And then there is the refusal to perform in person the treatment required. So I told you before that there are three different approaches. So the approach according to which there is an absolute right to object says that a doctor always has the right to protect his conscience, and doesn't matter which ones are the consequences for the patient. Doesn't matter if the patient will die or will be in terrible pain or anything. The conscience has a duty to protect his conscience, because conscience is the most important thing. And you might think that this is not a common approach, but it is, because the Bush administration in 2008 wanted to approve this provider refusal rule that allowed anyone working in the health context to refuse to perform any activity. Even the portier, the hospital, could refuse to give information to the patient, telling them where the doctor was. And then this rule was blocked by the Obama administration, fortunately. So the second approach is the moderate approach, and it's the view I want to criticize. The ones who support a moderate approach to conscientious objection think that the right to object is a prima facie right that must be compared with other rights that under different circumstances can be more compelling, overweighting the right to object. Basically, the moderate approach can be divided into two different subgroups. Some medicists believe that an indirect referral is sufficient. An indirect referral is what happens when the doctor is just supposed to inform the patient about the available treatments. Like if someone has been sexually abused and comes to the emergency hospital, then the doctor has the duty to inform her about the possibility to use a morning after pill in order to avoid a pregnancy. But then he's not supposed to give her the pill if it's against his conscience. Instead, in the case of a direct referral, the doctor has the duty to inform the patient about all the available treatments and has a duty to find a willing doctor that will give the treatment to the patient if he doesn't want to give the treatment himself. And if he cannot find another doctor, he's supposed to give the treatment himself to the patient. So you see, it's quite different, because in the first case, in the case of the indirect referral, at the end of the day, what matters is the conscience of the doctor. In the other case, in the case of the direct referral, what matters is the right to be cured of the patient. And finally, there are a few authors who deny any right to conscientious objection. I think I'm in this group, and I'm not in, yeah, this group is really small. In any case and context, and because they think that once a doctor decides to become a doctor and this choice is free and autonomous, then a doctor has the duty to provide every kind of safe and legal and beneficial treatment to the patient, even if it goes against his conscience. Well, anyway, I want to show what is wrong with the moderate approach. And I think there are two main reasons why this moderate approach doesn't persuade me at all. The first reason is more practical, and the first reason is more theoretical. First of all, I think that in a context where the number of conscientious objectors is too high, then the duty to refer the willing to a willing colleague cannot safeguard the patient. And on the other hand, I think that the duty to at least inform the patient about the possible treatment puts the doctor in this chain of events that they will bring the patient to get the kind of treatment he believes to be moral. So it doesn't safeguard the conscience of the patient. I think that is accomplished. There are three principles considered essential in order to evaluate when one has to establish if a refusal is legitimate or not. And these three principles are known as the three conventional conditions. According to the conventional compromise, a physician or pharmacist who has a serious moral objection to providing a service or a product to a patient is not required to do so only if the following three conditions are satisfied, and I'm using Dan Brock again. So the first condition is that the physician informs the patient about the service if it is medically relevant to their medical condition, and this is the case of the person who has been sexually abused and come to the hospital. She needs to know that it's possible to use the morning after pill. Or the second condition is that the pharmacy refers the patient to another professional willing and able to provide the service. So yes, I cannot provide you the prescription for the morning after pill, or I cannot provide you this abortion, but I will find you another colleague and you will go there. And finally, the referral does not impose an unreasonable burden on the patient. Which I think is a condition that usually is not respected in Italy, for instance. So I think that one objection could be, okay, but how many doctors are conscientious objectors? How widespread is this phenomenon of conscientious objection? Well, it is really widespread in Italy. I'm going to read you some data. So talking about gynecologists, in 2005, they were the 58.7%, and then in 2006, they were the 79.2%, and in 2007, they were the 70.5%. And in some regions, the percentage is above the 80%. For instance, in Lazio, where Roma is, the percentage is 85.6%, in Basilicata, 84.1%, and in Campania, where is Naples, 83.9%, and in Sicily, 83.5%. It's a huge number. And have you seen the percentage of objectors increases year by year? Why is that? Many people are becoming Catholics. The Catholic Church is persuading them. I don't think so. I think the reason is that since a little number of doctors performs abortions, the ones who are not objectors are really forced to perform just abortions. They cannot do anything else, because in one hospital there is just one doctor who is not an objector, then the only thing he does is to perform abortion. And then after 10 years, this doctor will say, why should I spend all my time doing abortion, which is not a kind of pleasant kind of intervention? I will become a conscientious objector. And this is why the percentage of objector is increasing year by year, and I expect to be almost the 100% in 10 years. Maybe I will tell you how the law about abortion works in Italy, so that you understand why this is a problem. Abortion can be performed just in public hospitals, so not in private clinics. You need an authorization signed by a doctor that proves that the pregnancy imposes you a terrible distress, and you know you will go mad if you are pregnant, and you know this is a really serious threat to your mental health. After this, you have to think about your decision for another week. And after 1 week, you can go to the hospital and ask to see a doctor for an abortion. But since the percentage of conscientious objector is so high, you usually have to wait until the end of the third month, which in Italy is the limit to have an abortion. And these have bad consequences, because stress of waiting for 2 months in order to get an abortion that you already decided to get, well, it's not a good thing for the patient. And also, it is more risky to have an abortion at the end of the third month instead of the first month. And it's less pleasant for the doctor who has to do the intervention. So the consequence, the practical consequence of all these conscientious objections are really serious. Also, consider that if there is no doctor willing to perform an abortion in a certain hospital, and this happens very often, because with the 85% of conscientious objectors, there are many hospitals with 100% of objectors. What happens? The hospital has to call a doctor from another hospital to perform the abortion. If there is no other available doctor, they have to call a doctor from another city or from another region, and the doctor will be paid some extra to do so. So the citizen who pays the taxes for the health system has to wait longer for the intervention, and then has to pay more indirectly because they have to pay more fees. So it seems there is something really unfair about imposing the burden of conscientious objection to all the citizenship. I recently read something about Spain as well, and it seems the percentage of conscientious objector is about the 90% in the public hospital, and this means that just the 10% performs abortion in public hospitals. Anyway, even if we won't completely forget about practical problems about the patient, even if we don't care at all about the patient, that's just a problem because they want to see they're guilty and they have to pay the price of conscientious objection because abortion is bad, I think that we need to consider the fact that the conscience of the doctor is not really protected by this moderate approach, by this conscience clause. According to Denbrock again, the complicity in wrongdoing can come in different degrees according to the different kind of activity the doctor performs. So according to Denbrock, if I am a doctor and I just inform the patient about the option to have an abortion because the fetus is affected by some serious disease, my degree of complicity is really minimal. Then, if I help the patient to find a doctor who will perform the abortion, my degree of complicity increases. And then, if I perform the abortion, my degree of complicity is maximum. I don't agree with this view. And the Catholic Church doesn't agree with me as well. We think this is the only situation where this happens. I don't think we can really understand or evaluate the degree of complicity. It's not really easy, and it is irrelevant. But I think we can use the example of a homicide to make it easier to us to understand why complicity in wrongdoing cannot be measured. Let's take the case of three people who want to kill someone. So, hypothesize that Jack kidnaps the chosen victim, Mark stuns her with some narcotics and buys a gun, and Tom pulls the trigger on. Can we really find relevant moral differences? It is true that Tom shot the victim and somehow he accomplished the plan. But the fact that he's the last in the chain doesn't imply that his accomplices doesn't bear relevant moral responsibilities. Indeed, it wouldn't be possible to Tom to shoot the victim if Jack wouldn't have kidnapped her and if Mark wouldn't have stunned her and bought the gun. We might spot some differences, but for instance, it seems reasonable to suppose that a doctor is an accomplice of this patient when he is involved in a chain of events that bring the woman to get an abortion. And I think it's proved quite easily from the example related to the homicide. Maybe from a legal point of view, it can make a difference if you are the one who shoots or you are the one who kidnaps. But from a moral point of view, I'm not sure it is true. And also, I'm not entirely sure that informing is the less relevant activity. I mean, if I don't know that I can have an abortion, I will never have an abortion. So it seems to me that the person who informs, that is the duty that anyway the moderate approach imposes on the doctor, has the highest level of responsibility and complicity in wrongdoing. Indeed, Catholic scholars believe that the moral right to conscientious objection should be attributed to every person who participates, even just remotely, to any activity that can be considered necessary and specifically connected to an abortion, from the cardiologist who has to do with an electrocardiogram, which is necessary because before the abortion, to the psychiatrist who has to certify that a woman is distressed because of the pregnancy, to the surgery assistant who has to give instruments to the surgeon during the abortion procedure. Catholics suggest that everyone should be allowed not to take part to any activity connected to abortion. But in this perspective, the number of people who could or should conscientiously object is virtually infinite. There are people involved in the production of pills, in who pack pills, prescribe, distribute, transport, test, and the chain of involvement in a moral activity is really long, and everyone plays a role. Just think of the person, of the taxi driver who would bring the woman from her house to the hospital. Isn't he responsible? I'm driving the taxi who will bring this person to kill a baby, in the Catholic perspective, not in mine. To conclude, if the reason why a doctor wants to use the conscience clause is his will not be an accomplice in an activity he deeply believes to be moral and wrong, that conscientious objection is not an adequate solution. For instance, to refuse to perform an abortion when one is making it possible to the patient to get the same treatment from another colleague means to be an accomplice and therefore to have an important moral responsibility. If the choice to object is based on the deep belief that an abortion is equivalent to an homicide, and it is the view of the Catholic Church, and not the people who object to abortion, then any kind of complicity is not morally justifiable. If instead one thinks that an abortion is not a homicide, then he needs to provide other and different reasons in order to justify his choice to object. Doctors who refuse to see that a lot of activities make of them accomplices and not just performing themselves the abortion, in my understanding, don't want to follow the path of a rational thought until the bitter end. Maybe because they don't like the conclusion, or maybe because they don't want to make an effort and think hardly through this issue. I don't know why. But if one has to follow a rational argument until the end, that is what I'm trying to do, then he sees clearly that there is just one alternative available. Either someone accepts the idea that his professional duties oblige him to perform any activity, safe and legal and beneficial, the patient requires, but otherwise someone has to renounce to start a career in the healthcare field in order to protect his conscience. There is no other option. I think that both choices are rational and morally justifiable, and it is up to the individual to decide which alternative is the best option to himself. But the only option that damages both the health practitioner and the patient is the solution that the moderate approach and that the conscientious objection clause suggest. Conscientious objector refuse to perform some activities, but who perform others' activities are not coherent and also prevent their patients from having the most efficient care. And this is a compromise that at the end of the day brings just bad consequences to both the doctor and the patients. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Francesca. So the floor is open for questions. Russell.
I'm wondering how much of this relates to sort of the public-private distinction between employment and... So, like, you know, if you're a lawyer, no one forces you to do any particular kind of law. I mean, maybe you have a conscientious objection to certain types of criminal law, so you just don't do that. Or you go into a law firm and... they say, okay, we want you to represent a tobacco company. You say, I don't want to do that. They say, okay, well, you don't have to, but then you can't work here. They say, okay, so you go work somewhere else. But I guess if you're a doctor in a system where you're going to work for a governmental healthcare system, then you may not have an option sort of to move around as you wish like that. So then why shouldn't you be allowed to essentially avoid the kinds of procedures and the kinds of work that you have a problem with? So, say you have a problem with abortion. Maybe if you're working in, I don't know, whatever area of the clinic, or you go through your intern or residency, maybe everyone has to deal with that at some point. But maybe that's not fair. I mean, maybe you should be able to pick within medicine which procedures you're comfortable with working on and not be forced to do all of them, because there seems to be no other profession that I could think of where they force you to work on every single area of that profession, because people might have a problem with some elements of it. So why should medicine force you to work on everything as opposed to sort of track you in ways that will be more consistent with your values, assuming you have no other alternative to employment as a doctor?
Well,
Or is this a misguided? I'm just...
Yeah, I think... Okay, we have to consider basically the fact that I'm talking about public system care, and therefore citizens pay through their taxes the doctor. So I'm paying you to give me some service, and then you say, well, no, I don't want to do this, and you can't. And it works for everyone working in the public sphere, I think. Like, you know, you cannot say, I am, how do you say these people who But you know, this is a jail which is in fire. I'm not going to save people in the jail because they're criminals. So I'm happy they die because, you know, you cannot do that. So in other professions as well, you cannot really choose what you want to do. It is true that in a private area you can decide. So I have any problem, don't have any problem with a doctor who is working in his private clinic and says, okay, I'm not going to prescribe you morning after pill. That's private. He can do whatever he wants to do. But in the public hospital, I think you have a strong duty.
Well, like, for example, in law you could. I mean, so if you're doing public law, you can just choose to do a type of law that you're comfortable with. A lot of people were not comfortable with doing criminal law, for example. So, there are professions that do let you pick the kinds of things that you want to work on. So why is it unreasonable to say that if someone does have a problem with abortions or those kinds of procedures, that we're going to track them through medicine, but we're just going to make sure that they don't need to work on those kinds of things that they have.
Well, they shouldn't become gynecologists or cardiologists,
right?
Or, you can be a dentist and you will never be involved in an abortion. But once
why should every doctor have to be involved in an abortion?
I think we should probably move on because we've got a lot of questions. Is that another one at the back? Yeah, I'll put you on the list. I had a question over here. Yes, you.
Yeah. So I have a point about this tension that you brought up about how is it really true that the doctor in this compromise is kind of still is still losing his integrity, so to speak, when he has this indirect reference. He refers the patient externally. You say it's irrational because the abortion is wrong. He's just as complicit as if he had performed the abortion himself, right? But I mean, why should we? Well, he doesn't believe that. The doctor doesn't believe that. The doctor feels like his integrity is violated when he just refers the patient.
Yeah, but this is hypocritical. I mean, it's just you just don't want to see the truth.
The truth
is that you're an accomplice and you're doing something wrong. Because if that was really a homicide, you would never give information to someone where to find a gun to kill someone. So maybe they don't agree that an abortion is a homicide, but then they have to agree with themselves. Because...
My worry is just that the reason for allowing conscious objections, there's this question of whether or not there's a rationality requirement, which is really important. So if you say, okay, the reason we're going to allow these conscious objections is because we worry about the interests of the doctor, then we shouldn't be thinking about, is the doctor being hypocritical? We should be thinking about, are we forcing doctors to do something they really don't want to do? Why should whether or not they're being hypocritical come into that determination? Maybe they're being really irrational, but they still, if they perform this abortion, would feel really bad. But if they didn't perform the abortion but just recommended, they wouldn't feel really bad. What if that's the interest that they're trying to do?
Yeah, so why should I pay the doctor and go through the burden of find another doctor and, you know, affect the functioning of the system because of an irrational desire, of the doctor? Why?
But then I can say the same thing. Because if as a society we decide abortion is permissible, we're already disagreeing with the doctor at one level. Right? We're already disagreeing with the doctor about the permissibility of abortion. Why can't we disagree with them about this further point, about the rationality of their...
Because it has bad consequences to me, to you, to everyone. I mean, if you want to be irrational in your own house and do crazy things, I don't care. But if you come to me and you want to impose your irrational choices on me, well, I mean, I have something to do about that, to say about that. I don't want it. That's why I'm interested in this topic, because the consequence of this irrationality follows on me.
Okay, I think we have to move on from that. Lisa.
Thank you for the talk. It's very interesting. And I think I agree with you on that this might be a big problem, especially when there are so many using to use this conscientious objection thing. But my question was actually, because I agree with you, I'm starting to suspecting that the reason I agree about this conscientious objection thing is because I think that abortion should be legal and should be available to women. So my question to you is really, are there any other areas within medicine where people actually use this conscientious objection that doesn't have to do with abortion? Because that would be interesting just, you know, to have something to compare it with.
Yeah, euthanasia. Well, in the countries where euthanasia is legal, usually there is a conscience clause. And it is used in some countries also for the morning after pill. And, this conscience rule that Bush proposed was about every kind of practice, like blood transfusion and, every kind of activity that someone could find morally wrong. Abortion is the most famous, the most relevant, I think, issue because it's more widespread. But it can potentially be applied to every kind of... also like the use of pills developed using stem cells, embryo stem cells. So yeah, it applies to a lot of...
Okay, I had a question up here.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. Really interesting. Thank you. One of your objections to the moderate approach was that if enough doctors had a conscientious objection, then we'd find that the patient would come into a lot of difficulty. And you gave some examples about how women have had to wait another couple of months to have access to an abortion. But actually, I think that Dan Brock's conventional compromise already accounts for that, because in the third condition he says that the conventional compromise should be allowed unless it causes unreasonable burden to the patient. And it strikes me that waiting for 2 months for an abortion is exactly that, an unreasonable burden for the patient. So do you not think it's already covered by, your objection is actually already accounted for by Dunbrock's compromise.
I mean, I completely agree that, you know, the problem is that the burden on the patient is excessive. But it is really subjective to evaluate this burden, because someone will say, yeah, what is the problem? You have to wait 2 months, but I have to kill your baby, you know. I mean, so I think that this point of the excessive burden is not sufficient, because you cannot evaluate objectively the burden imposed to the patient and the burden imposed to the doctor. Because to someone, killing a fetus could be an unbearable burden and heavier than waiting for 2 months. So that's why I think it's not the final solution to the problem.
Hey, Alex.
Hi. I was wondering whether some people might object your proposal on in terms of expected consequences. So if your proposal were to be made low, rather than understanding it just as a point about maybe the virtues of good doctors, someone might accept that what you said is correct. So doctors who resort to conscientious objection in some way lack one of the virtues of a good doctor, but they might still say, in terms of expected consequences, if you outlaw conscientious objection, then a significant proportion of doctors who currently use it will decide not to go into practice where they might be forced to practice, for instance, abortions, and then we're going to have a shortage of people in these areas of medicine. So what would you respond to that?
Yeah, that is one of the consequences that can could derive in case conscientious objection wouldn't be allowed. But I mean, if we look at Sweden and Oregon, where there is no conscience clause, they don't have this problem, so we have good reason to think that it wouldn't be the same in other countries. And I also think that the development of a chemical, RU486, the treatments in order to have abortion will help a lot on this practical problem, because a person just needs to take a pill and then there will be no one doing the surgery. But yeah, that's a good point, and I think we should try, and then if we have this problem, maybe we can introduce conscientious objection again, but yeah.
Okay, Jill.
Yeah, I mean, if I understood you well, I mean, your main objection or your main, the main problem that you see with conscientious objection is that it makes for women too difficult to have an abortion, because as soon you allow it, I mean, it's so widespread, at least in Italy, the same in Spain, and I think here in England it's more or less the same in the public sector. But if that is the argument, it's something that depends only on the numbers. I mean, would you say the same? Would you say that conscientious objection is wrong even in a country where only 1% of the doctors object? Because I think you need a stronger argument, because if we are in a country where we can allow conscientious objection and it's not really used, then what would you say?
Well, I mean, there would be bad consequences. So, I mean, I think one of the solutions would be like to decide, okay, the 10% could be conscientious objector and not more. That would be a practical solution. But I think that a principle, in order to be good, should apply and should be useful in the extreme situation. So the question we have to ask is, what happens if the 100% of doctors is objector? Not if what happens if the 1% of doctor is a conscientious objector. Because, you know, both the questions are relevant to test the goodness of a moral principle. And, you know, if we say, okay, there is a moderate right to conscientious objection, and then 100% of doctors is a conscientious objector, we have no good reason to justify the moderate approach. And it's true that if it's just 1%, it's fine. But then, you know, how should we decide which doctors can be allowed to be objectors? Why? How can we decide? I don't know. And then I think it's important to consider the moral duties of a doctor. I mean, once you decide to become a gynecologist, at least, well, you know, that's your job. And otherwise, you should do something else. Nobody's forcing you to become a gynecologist.
Question over here. Is that a question?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I'll put you on the list, but over here first.
This is, in fact, I've got two questions. One is actually related to the first question that was that is regarding a comparison.
Sorry, I don't understand English very well. If you could just lower throat. Thank you.
I've got two queries. One is, in fact, pertaining to the first question that was relating to the comparison of the medical profession and the legal profession. And the second one is regarding the Hippocratic Oath. Now, I'll go to the first one. So, in fact, there was a comparison, kind of comparison between the medical profession and legal profession, and where it was in fact that the doctors are being forced. But I think when we consider a group of doctors, I mean, or a group of professionals, then all the professionals, whatever be the profession, be it a medical profession or the legal profession, when all of them, in fact, the percentage of conscientious objectors increases. I guess right now in legal profession, probably, I don't know, not more than say 10% would be conscientious objectors. Like, I will not defend a rapist. But if all the lawyers take a view that I am not going to defend a rapist or a murderer, then probably this issue will be a problem even as far as the profession is concerned. So my question is, therefore, whatever be the profession, isn't there a obligation to be professional towards the society at large? And especially, now I come to the second question, that is relating to the Hippocratic Oath. Though the original Hippocratic Oath in fact contained something which prevented abortion and prevented the administration of lethal drugs, the modern version that we have right now, in fact, that says that we are treating a human person and not a disease. We are treating a human person. And that in such a way that his illness does not affect the society, does not affect his family and his economic stability. So, doesn't the Hippocratic Oath put an obligation on the doctor? The modern Hippocratic Oath, does it put an obligation on the doctor to irrespective of his views, to look at the case, understand it in the context. Probably in certain cases abortion might be required because it might be dangerous for the health of the mother. In that case, if I put a lady or a pregnant woman in a reserve list so that she could be treated at the third month of pregnancy, then that might be in fact against her best interest. So in that sense, actually the concept of conscientious objection is a big conflict with the duty of a doctor to the society at last.
Okay, so very long and complicated question. I will try to answer. So first question, yeah, I agree with you that all the people who enter a certain profession voluntarily, they have professional duties, and yeah, it works with the lawyers. And my difference is between people working in the public context and the private context. So I think that people who work in the public context, they have a little room for choice, and they are supposed to do what their clients or patients require. And the private context is different. The other point is that you were asking about what happens if a woman cannot have an abortion because this will bring bad consequences to their health. Well, in that case, the doctor who refuses to perform the abortion is not using a religious or a moral reason. It's a scientific. It's based on another argument, the refusal to perform the abortion. It's not, I'm not practicing the abortion because I think it's immoral. I'm not practicing the abortion because it's dangerous for your health, and you cannot use the conscience clause in order to refuse this kind of treatment. But also in that case, I think that it is a right of the patient to decide to risk to die in order to get an abortion if she thinks that it's worth it to risk.
Can I make a small clarification?
Just a small one. Because
A very small clarification. Because I was not actually thinking of a situation where the doctor uses a scientific reason to prevent abortion. I'm not thinking of such a situation.
Oh, sorry, misunderstood you.
Yeah, what I was mentioning was a case where it is essential to have an abortion. Because in order to, it is essential to have an abortion.
Yeah.
Because it is detrimental to the health of the, if the pregnancy is continued, that might affect the health. And then the doctor says no, because my religious views does not permit me to. I'm speaking,
I understand
that context, what would be the obligation?
It depends. I mean, as far as I know, in Italy you're obliged to perform an abortion if the person is at risk to die in that moment. You're obliged to perform the abortion. But it's not the same in Ireland, for instance. I think that abortion is illegal in Ireland. I'm not sure about this. I'm sure about the Italian law. So it depends on the context. And yes, I mean, that would be even worse to refuse to practice an abortion to someone who is dying. Yeah.
Okay, it's over here.
Yeah. I had a couple points through the course of your talk I wanted you to elaborate on a little bit or touch on. One would be if you could focus a little bit on an understanding of what the purpose of the profession actually is. So in the beginning, you're talking about somebody who might be kind of just an objector, be silly to say I'm going to kill people only with guns and not bombs or something like this. But I think a more realistic example would be somebody might be in the military and their commander tells them to bomb a village full of innocent people. And they would say, wait a minute, that's not what I signed up for. That's not the purpose of me being a soldier. And I think similarly, you could say that as a physician, their duty is to uphold and promote life. They can't just go around willy-nilly saying, oh, you know, this is what I think, and I think I hold this really firmly. Therefore, it's a conscientious objection. I think it has to be rooted in an idea towards what's the purpose of their profession. So there's a legitimate role to say, I'm a physician, my role is to uphold and promote life. And that seems legitimate to me. Second point was, I think, to understand the mechanism of the case that you're presenting. And that is, it seems a woman has been raped and she comes into the physician. As an aside, I think it's really bad to make policy off exceptions. I think most abortions are 95% or more abortion on demand. I think that's really where the issue lies. But that aside, if somebody comes in and says, I've just been raped, to understand what is the morning after pill. That's a progestin only pill that makes the womb uninhabitable to an embryo. Or it also thickens the cervical mucus, so it even prevents the sperm from uniting with an egg, so you don't even have a union. And I think that's some nuance that's worth discussing within this debate, whether you're Catholic or Protestant or not. And I think that might help, and I'd be curious to get your comment on a couple of those things.
Okay, so the purpose of our profession. Why do you say that the purpose of the doctor is to promote life? Why? I mean.
Well, it's not death, certainly. I mean.
I think that the duty of a doctor is to promote the well-being of the patient, not the life. I mean. Think about euthanasia. A good doctor, in my understanding, is the one who can help the patient to die if the quality of the life of the patient is minimal and the patient doesn't want to keep on living. So it's not promoting life, it's promoting well-being. And the understanding of what well-being is subjective. It's up to the patient. And there is this disease, Julian Savulescu, taught in a paper, this is called a condition, not disease, called apotemnophilia. These people have four limbs and they want to have an amputation of healthy limbs because they don't feel happy, they don't feel this limb as a part of their body and ask for an amputation. And they feel much better after the arm or the leg is amputated. So well-being is subjective. What is my well-being is just my business. The point of informing the patient, just explaining how the morning after pill works. Well, if you talk to a Catholic doctor, he will tell you that anyway, the morning after pill prevents the implantation of the potential zygote. So it prevents the development of the embryo, and it is immoral. That's why a lot of doctors refuse to sign the prescription for a morning after pill, to fill the prescription for a morning after pill. And I remember I read a paper once, it was this pharmacist who refused to give the pill, but also threw away the prescription so that the patient couldn't go to another pharmacy to get a pill. Some ideas are not rational. I mean, believing that using the morning after pill is something like an homicide is not rational. But doctors believe this, but it shouldn't be my problem. And they won't tell the patient how the morning after pill works. They won't fill the prescription and, I don't know, I mean, informing. How can they inform if they don't know how it works? If they're full of irrational ideas, I don't know.
Okay, we're going to move on. Schleimitz.
Thanks, very interesting. I want to ask about the inconsistencies in the doctor's beliefs when they are willing to inform about, for example, the morning after pill, but not give it themselves. You seem to be operating then within the Catholic moral perspective. But I was also wondering whether you offer or you think an argument should be offered from a moral perspective, or perhaps that of a liberal Catholic, who would say something like this. I strongly believe that this treatment ends life unjustly, and therefore I am opposed to it. But I recognize a plurality of values, and I also recognize a person's autonomy. And so I am willing to, the act of informing them is not intended to facilitate the ending of life, though it is a means towards that. Rather, my intention is to show respect for their autonomy. In the same way that if I buy my mother cigarettes, my intention is not to help her die from lung cancer, but to respect her autonomy. And that is different from your example of murder, where all the three people had the same intention, which was to bring about the unjust death of a person through different means.
Yeah, well, I think that it depends on the kind of moral approach you have. I judge the consequences. So even if that's not my intention, but that's the consequence, I'm unaccomplished, I'm doing something wrong, even if that was not my intention. Well, of course, from a different perspective, deontological perspective, people can have a different approach to the issue and judge the intention. But in my approach to morality, what matters is the consequence. And in this case, this is the consequence, that if I know that I can use the morning after pill, I will maybe use it, and I will kill the zygote. Thanks.
Okay, question over here. Yes, you. If you had a question, I didn't recognise your hair, but I'm happy to put you on the list.
So I have a general question, and he's begun to answer it now. So he spoke a lot about duties and rights, and now he spoke about consequences as well, and I guess he was saying you're a consequentialist about things. I was wondering if your approach, well, firstly, if you're a consequentialist, and you said a doctor, once he freely, autonomously decides to become a doctor, has a duty calling to perform his role. That sounds like something that's incompatible with consequentialism. Surely there'll be some cases where performing whatever doctors are expected to perform might not lead to those consequences. Well, secondly, the question I want to ask, first of all, is your approach only defensible if you assume consequentialism, or can you be a deontologist or a virtue ethicist and go and be persuaded by your argument? Does that make sense?
Well, so if I am a consequentialist, yeah. There is this is kind of some of my PhD thesis. So there are different arguments I took into account. So there are, yes, principles and consequences and duties and, yes, there is a lot of stuff, maybe too much. So maybe the approach is not entirely coherent and just purely consequentialist. You're right.
And as a consequentialist, you seem to align yourself with a view where doctors have this duty. How do you interpret duty as a consequentialist? Like, what does that mean? Duty sounds like regardless of the consequences, you ought to do or not to do something.
I mean, in general, even if you're a consequentialist, you have the duty to act morally. And
right.
in the case of a doctor, it means that you have the duty to promote the well-being of your patient. This is the way I see the duties in the context of consequence. It's not that a consequentialist doesn't have any principle of or moral duty. I mean,
well, there's one, right? Maximum good or something.
But I mean, it depends on which kind of utilitarian approach you embrace, if you hedonistic or something else. But yeah, there is room for duties also in a consequentialist approach.
Okay, Julian.
And so my latest thought is that the National Health Service is the last bastion of communism in Europe, and that the GP is the KGB or the Stasi, the enforcers, the levelling down equality of his service. And the reason that I say that is I just got back from Australia, and I got this very good friend, he's a professor of cardiology, and he measured all my blood lipids, and he said, well, you have a complex profile. But essentially, the lower your cholesterol, the lower your risk of heart disease, and the drugs are very safe today. I would go on them. So he put me on one. But I come back here, and I went to the GP here, and I said, look, you know, I'm on this cholesterol lowering agent. And he said, well, you know, we don't put people on cholesterol lowering agents in your category, in your age, because it hasn't been shown to be cost effective. And what that means is that they're happy if 10, 20, 100, 200 people die because it saves an enormous amount of money. And I said, well, you know, I'm prepared to pay. And he said, well, it will cost you £25 a month to go on the drug that you're on here. And I think this is deeply morally wrong. I think that the system we have in Australia, which is a mixed public and private system, is far superior. And in that sense, I'm partly a libertarian, but let's say I'm just a libertarian. And I'm looking for a conscientious objector to the NHS as my GP. I want somebody who holds my libertarian values, who objects to this communism of the NHS, and will try to find a way to prescribe me or allow me to pay for my own healthcare. Because, of course, here, if you're dying of cancer, you can't even pay for your own chemotherapy because they'd prefer that you die like everybody else rather than get some sort of unequal advantage. And I think this is deeply wrong. So I'm in favour of conscientious objection, in favour of libertarianism and opposed to this kind of cognitive, and I would suspect you would be too. I think what you really object to is religious conscientious objection, and not conscientious objection per se.
Well, irrational conscientious objection, first of all, and against the conscientious objection that prevents people to have more choices. So I didn't have the chance to mention these in my paper here, but in my thesis there is a chapter about this. And it is like, if you take the case of a doctor who wants to perform abortions in the conscientiously objects to the law that doesn't legalize abortion in a country where abortion is illegal, I would be in favor of that. I think he has all the good reasons, because he's offering a service. Is giving a chance to people, so he's increasing the options. And in my understanding, having more option is a good thing, and having less option is a bad thing. So the doctors who doesn't perform the abortions in a country where it is legal is reducing the chances and the opportunities of his patients, and the doctors performing abortions in a country where it is legal is doing something good, because he's offering something, a different option. Yeah, so I completely agree. I'm not in principle against conscientious objection. I'm in principle against irrational conscientious objection and against objection that refuses, that, that reduces the choices.
Okay, question over here.
Yeah.
So I think someone, so I'm a practicing physician from the United States. I'm a bioethicist there. And so I think you were getting at this idea of the end of medicine, of the medical profession. And I think that if you use the Rawlsian idea of overlapping consensus, there actually is not one, of what are the ends of the medical profession. And so I think what ends up happening, as in your talk in this debate, is that people use the scenario of abortion, and that clouds and confounds the issue. So let me continue on for a second, then I'll ask you the question. So as you mentioned, diseases and cures are socially and culturally constructed. Right? So some societies have different understandings of what is disease. You know, some cultures, if I even say epilepsy is not a disease. We're getting on this debate about genetic enhancement, right, and transhumanism. So there is not, again, not an overlapping consensus what the ends of medicine are and what the goals of a medical profession might be. And because of that, I think that is a chunk. So if you're saying that, hey, this is the obligations and duties of the physician, I don't know necessarily if you have a solid ground because that doesn't necessarily exist. So here's the question. Now, I think two frames, potentially other than abortion, might shed light on, your, on this issue. One being, you reduce the physician to a state actor, okay? And there's many different models of the physician-doctor relationship from Emmanuel and from Brody and Quill. And we talk about moving from a paternalistic model to one that on one end is informative or deliberative or whatever you want to say, where the physician is not just a technocrat who gives a technology, but rather engages in the values of the patient and their own and come up with what's the best solution to this place. What you're reducing physician to is just an informative, here's a technocrat technology and do the service, consumers. So I think that practicing physicians might not necessarily agree with that, and our medical ethics don't use a physician as just a technocrat, right? So here's the issue. Here's two other examples. Here's the examples that might help you frame the debate. One is complicity in torture. So physicians, if they're just state actors, you might say that I would like you to witness this person who's being tortured to make sure they don't die. This is in the benefit of the society because we're going to get some information from them that might benefit our entire society, right? And then secondly, because you're there, you're going to protect your patient from dying. So this is a good. Yet I don't have seen debates where this conscientious objection is actually good and part of the profession. We move and we check the excesses of our state, of our government. A second frame might be where on the patient side, we have religious objection to vaccines. So we believe a public health scale, we should give, on a public health scale, we should give vaccines to have a public benefit. Yet we allow for religious exemption for vaccinations because we hold the patient's values to supersede those of the state and the physician. So if that is the case, then how come the physician does not have the same rights, you see?
Sorry, can you repeat the second point?
So patient values in the medical encounter sometimes trump physicians. So I am allowed, a patient says, I don't want a vaccine. Mm-hmm. My religion doesn't allow this vaccine.
Yeah.
All of the public health benefit is known. Right? Although as a physician, I believe this is in the best interest of that patient particularly, the patient's values trump mine because they have to, right? I have to say, okay, you don't have to get the medicine, the vaccine, because you don't agree with it. So on one end, you have the patient allowing that, but you're not allowing the physician to do the same.
Yeah.
So I think that those two other scenarios might,
yeah,
you know, decompound the picture.
Yeah, so I'll start from this last question. Yeah, I mean, it's obvious that patients and doctors don't have the same duties. I mean, I don't decide to be a patient. I am a patient by default. I mean, I am born, I am this system, and if I need care, I have to go to doctor. But the moment I decide to become a doctor, you know, I go to the faculty of medicine and I then become a gynecologist, well, I mean, then I am a kind of signing a contract, an implicit contract with society telling, you know, I will help you to increase your well-being. And it's different, the conscientious objection of the... So if we get back to the example of the military service, it's different because you don't have any choice. If you are a male about 18 years old in a country where the military service is compulsory, you have to undergo the military service. But in the case of the doctor, and it's the case, the parallel with the patient, I'm a patient, or I'm supposed to enter the military service. In the case of the doctor, nobody obliged you to become a doctor. And the moment you become a doctor, you are signing this implicit contract.
So that's why I'm ignoring you. There's no overlapping consensus of the ends of medicine. There is not one.
So I think we better move on. Sorry, but we're really running out of time. But a question up here. Can we make a point, please?
Yeah, it's very brief. It's just I wanted to focus on the military example and the legal example that was brought forth at the beginning of the debate. I just thought about that. So my feeling was rather that when you're talking about a soldier or a doctor performing certain practices as a soldier, understanding that you know what practices you're going to have to perform as a doctor when you sign up for it, and I'm not talking about gynecology, it's a general, there is a general consensus of what you'll have to do in that society in that moment as a doctor. And as a soldier, when you sign up, you know that you may have to shoot people. Is it not more that case rather than your commanding officer coming along and saying, form that village of innocent people? Because that's not what you sign up to do when you're a soldier. You don't sign up to kill innocent people.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to go back to the example of the torture. I mean, if you become a doctor, you're not supposed to know that you will be asked to torture someone. This is not in the duties of a doctor. But, you know, if you're a gynecologist, well, you have a lot of chances to be required to practice an abortion. So, I mean, I don't see the parallel between the torture and the abortion in the case of a doctor.
I was just saying, if you're a state actor, we reduce a position to a state actor, and the state's actions of what the duty of the profession are might change.
Slow down, sorry?
So if the physician's a state actor only, you sign up to do abortions or whatever you might be as a physician,
yeah.
Tomorrow the state might say, I sign you up to do torture. Because if you're basing it all on the idea the state decides what your duties and obligations are, that can change. And in that scenario, you might want conscientious objection.
Well, it's different, because if you decide to, I mean, I think it makes sense to have conscientious objection clause, for instance, in countries where abortion is introduced recently. So for all the doctors who entered the profession before abortion was legal, because they couldn't know that abortion was going to become legal at some point. But for all the ones who entered the profession later, the legalization of abortion, it doesn't make any sense to have a right to refuse to do something you are supposed to do, like a basic duty of your profession. I mean, if you're a gynecologist, what should you do? Visit people, make people bored, and abortions. I mean, it's not that you have a lot of stuff. It's like, you know, I want to be a dentist, but, you know, I don't want to clean or... This is one of the basic duties, not something unexpected.
Okay.
If someone comes to me as a philosopher and asks an abortion, that would be unexpected. But in ecologists, it makes a lot of sense.
That would be very unexpected. I think we're going to make this the last question. So you.
Yeah, because I'm tired. Mine is a very quick question, actually, and I am a doctor and not just a study room, and I agree with you, I'm not speaking to Nathan. I'm just wondering, given that things are changing and evolving so rapidly, you know, when I train, you know, I would have known about stem cells and medication, etc. So how on a practical level could you see, you know, your comment was, if you don't want to have to do, you know, don't want to have to do this, then you don't go into medicine. How do you see that sort of evolving over the next few years when things are changing so much?
Yeah, well, I think that that someone who decides to become a doctor knows or should know that medicine evolves and makes progress very quickly. And, you know, someone who decides to become a doctor now should know or should think carefully about this decision, and he should know that maybe in 10 years he will be required to practice euthanasia also in countries where it's not allowed, or to use medicine obtained through stem cells, or to do things that we cannot even imagine now, because they are so so far from our knowledge now. But medicine is in progress, and this is one of the main characteristics of medicine. So I think that a person who decides to become a doctor should bear up this in mind before deciding. I think it's a very hard. This is connected to what I said before, you know, to to be moral is really hard, to be a moral agent, to take the right decision, to think carefully and to bring your reason up to the bitter end, even if you don't like the consequence, if you don't like. Well, if you decide to become a doctor now, you should take all these developments of medicine into account.
I think it is tricky though, because it's certainly in my country, people go into the first year of medicine age 18. So if they don't go in as a graduate, they don't.
Sorry, in your country?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't hear you, sorry.
In my country, in New Zealand, people go into medicine aged 18, I mean, that's their first year. So it's actually, and I mean, so that's an argument, I think, that they go in later, having a change in the structure, but I think, on a purely practical level, asking an 18-year-old to consider these issues is...
Yeah, well, but, you know, 18, 20, at some point you have to take this decision and to be ready to... Well,
I agree, but I don't think 18-year-olds are
actually... Okay, well, thanks.